If you like betting on golf, but everyone that you back misses the cut, get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the golf betting system. The golf betting system is the golf betting system podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Golf Betting System podcast. It's episode 401. This is our 2026 United States Open Championship In-Depth Research Podcast. Barry O'Hanrahan and Paul Williams join me, Steve Bamford, to discuss the third major of the 2026 season at Shinnecock Hills Golf Club. Good morning, chaps.
Morning, guys.
Morning, guys.
This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. Please be gamble aware. You can visit gambleaware.org for more information. And, of course, please bet responsibly. Visit our world-famous Golf Betting System website where we have our US Open research preview. We've got detailed US Open form and major championship form stats. Plus, from Monday the 15th of June, our US Open new and old version predictor models. All of our content is available completely free of charge. There is no paywall or registration required. We're available on X. You can follow Barry at A Good Talk Golf. Paul is at Golf Betting. I am at Bamford Golf. On Blue Sky, search for Steve Bamford and Paul Williams. Subscribe to the Steve Bamford Golf YouTube channel, where this podcast is available each and every week. Now, you guys as listeners power this podcast, so we need your five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, as ever. For those of you who leave a review, I'll read them out at the start of a future show. Leave your name and where you are in the review. This is from Jack. Jack is in Connecticut. Entitled, Excellent as Always. Just listen to the Charles Schwab podcast and as usual, we'll see if it was time profitably spent. I have to get this off my chest. I love your intro music, but each time I hear it, I find myself waiting for one last word following podcast. I think it needs to end on the word show. So listen along and try saying it. You guys are more than an information podcast. You are an entertainment show. Just a suggestion for an updated theme lyric. Sometimes the smallest of detail can make all the difference. Cheers and keep up the good work. Your loyal listener from Connecticut, Jack. Jack, thanks for your feedback. Much appreciated.
Nice one, Jack. Doesn't sound like Sam's getting a Grammy anytime soon. He's not getting his lyrics bang on.
Yeah. Interesting thought, isn't it? I don't know. These things evolve, but don't know.
Sam, to be fair to him, did us a solid. Penning the team tune for us, so who are we can't critique that. Like, thank you very much, mate. We've got that going for us.
Yeah, I've often thought of a new lyric or intro that's stuff in there like wacky, those kind of lyrics.
Just a mix up of Steve mispronouncing things and going off the chain.
Matsuyama, it's Matsuyama.
Yeah. You could have a variety of ones that you use tactically, couldn't you, for different events?
It'd be far too long for all my ridiculous pronunciations.
It could have a little hint in it as to what was going to come in the selections later on. Anyway, food for thought, Jack. Thanks for taking the time to write the review and for your feedback. Always appreciated.
Our US Open Tips podcast is just around the corner. It will be there for your eardrums on Tuesday, the 16th of June. So Paul, Barry and myself will go through our selections for the US Open on that particular podcast, which will be 402. So just bear that in mind when you're listening to this. This is more of a research trends, golf course, potential weather type podcast. And we'll have a little look back, I think, chaps, also at 2018. Because, in the grand scheme of things, Brooks Koepka's victory here where you go to a lot of these venues, like a Ronaming this year, no one had a clue what was going to happen effectively. They'd had a BMW championship there in ridiculously wet conditions that Keegan Bradley had won, but that in no way, shape or form linked to what the PGA championship setup was like at all. At least with this, we know that Shinnecock is A, going to be hard, B, going to be windy, C, going to be pretty firm as a golf course, and that isn't going to be a million miles away from what we actually saw here in 2018.
Yeah, proper test. And
it's a beast of a golf course, it has to be said.
Yeah, just looking at the result from 2018 and the scoring gives you an indication as to how tough it can be, but it looks, let's hope it materializes, because I think as a major, the US Open does set itself apart from the others by being one that kind of aims at level par as the winning score. And if that's where we end up or thereabouts this week, then, or this coming week, then I think they've done their job.
Now, I'm sure to be placing plenty of my US Open bets with Bet365. If you are 18 plus and do not have a Bet365 sports account, you can find details of their Bet £10. Get £30 in free bets, new customer promotion, plus a link through to that very offer with T's and C's in this podcast description. Of course, the World Cup has also started, so there's going to be lots of opportunities to have a bet over the incoming weeks. Visit golfbettingsystem.co.uk/365. That's golfbettingsystem.co.uk/365 for £30 of free bets with Bet365. Let's talk Shinnecock Golf Course first. I'll take you through the basic details. It's a William S. Flynn 1937 original. It had a Coran Crenshaw renovation in 2012. Now, we saw that renovation at the 18 renewal. Course type, I have this down as technical in terms of its scoring. If this becomes a double digit under par winning total, I think I'll pack it all in. So people will be listening to this praying for a double digit winning score. It's an inland links golf course. It is long in length. If you look at the USGA website, they're quoting 7,434 yards. It is a par 70, only two par fives. Holes with water hazards in play, just the one. Fairways, bent grass with Poana, rough, Kentucky bluegrass, Ryan Fescue. The greens are 6,000 square feet on average, featuring a mix of bent grass with Poana. Now, I've actually worded this on the preview as Poana with bent grass, because when you look at the greens themselves, they are quoted as around about 80% Poana with 20% bent grass. Some of the greens, and it all depends on the time of year as well, some of the greens come in kind of a split of 50-50.
Mm.
So predominantly Poa with a mix of various different bent grasses within them as well. So they're your typical coastal kind of mismatch of grasses.
Mm, yeah, and we see that on some of the linksy courses up in Scotland in particular, where the kind of the indigenous grasses are allowed to just be what they are, and you end up with this kind of mix. As you say, I mean, aesthetically, looking back at the old pictures, it looks predominantly Poa, because of the you can kind of get a feeling of that when you eyeball the greens. But yeah, there's got to be some variance in there between green to green by the sounds of it.
The other thing I think is worth mentioning is when we picture Poana, we always think, don't we, Torrey Pines, Pebble Beach. I have to say that West Coast Poana and East Coast Poana are different animals. The Poa over in the northeast of the United States is far smoother than Poana that you get over on the West Coast in California.
Yeah.
So just bear this in mind. You can't just look at, say, a Torrey Pines golf course and set of players that play there well and go, oh, yeah, these guys are beasts on Poana greens, and just relay that straight across to East Coast Poana and Bentgrass Poana golf courses. It's not quite that simple. I think these greens over here on the East Coast putt a lot truer.
Yep, get that.
Now, this course, as of 2018, played at 74.65 as an average across the field, across all four rounds. Yes, it played 4.65 strokes per round over par. And amazingly enough, he says with sarcasm, it was the most difficult golf course on the PGA Tour that year.
Not surprisingly.
Barry, I know you love your architecture. I know you're into your golf courses. You spend time researching, taking them in. I know that you watch a lot of PGA Tour golf and you are perturbed at the golf courses that they go to. This is the kind of course that I would assume is what you would like in terms of a major championship golf test. What do you think to Shinnecock from your research and from what you can remember from 2018?
Obviously a very difficult golf course. Always testing you. No easy pars, especially when the wind is up. So, I mean, the best tip I can give to anybody is go check out the fried egg architecture video they put up on YouTube, about a 30-minute video, and that was released there just about a week ago. A couple of the boys played it, and it just gives you a really good feel for what's going on in the course, and you learn a lot more about it than just looking at the numbers or some photos. Look, these are amateurs playing a course that the pro is going to play, but you can certainly get a really... might help you with some of your bets, just kind of getting a feel for what kind of player might adapt to the challenge presented next week. I love the rugged kind of look of the bunkers. I love the width on the fairways. Width and angles should matter for approaching these greens, especially if there's the wind involved, which we'll get to the wind in a little bit. I'm extremely excited to watch this next week.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it should be a good test. And yeah, I guess over time the course has evolved because they have removed virtually all of the trees, so it does look exposed. It does look wide, doesn't it, when you kind of eyeball it? From previous videos, very link. Would you describe it as a lynx? I guess it's close enough aesthetically in the way it plays to be described as such. Certainly, I think you're going to need to have that kind of the shot styles or the shot shapes or the putting and chipping decisions around the holes, bit of creativity. That, you know, it's going to lend itself to that kind of player, I guess.
Yeah, I think for all intents and purposes, we have to treat it like a lynx. Lynx land, maybe a tiny bit of heathland kind of vibe going on, but it's... yeah, it's as close to what you'd get as a Scottish-Irish links. So, and the ground's going to be firm and fast. There's contours there. So that's at least the approach I'll be taking for picking my players for next week. I'll be putting a lot of focus on who goes well on links courses and obviously plays well in the wind. I presume you've highlighted wind on the GPS predictor, lads. It'll be a factor.
Well, it's going to be a variable when they're regardless, because I think we were still a week out from the start, so the actual forecast will need to be firmed up. But given the proximity to the sea and the way the course is oriented, then it's going to have some impact and some influence from the wind and from the sea over the course of the 4 days.
I think what I take from the course is how open it is. It's such an open property. They've got rid of any trees. It reminds me of Oakmont from last year, but clearly Oakmont's not right next to the coast. The other idea here is that you know, with this, it's an ever-changing routing. So, you know, the real challenge, players, they're just constantly thinking about wind direction and where the wind's coming from, how it's going to affect the ball.
Yeah. Mm.
And you just look at it as well. I mean, I'll take you through, actually, the US Open par 70s of recent times and where this comes in from a yardage perspective. If you look at 22, they played the Country Club at Brookline, Matt Fitzpatrick. That was a 7,264-yard par 70. Oakmont last year played at 7,372. They're all par 70s. Los Angeles Country Club, where Wyndham Clark won, was 7,421 in 2003. Shinnecock Hills then plumps itself in there, 7,434. It's being quoted as 9 yards shorter, but you know, it's here or there. They'll move tees around compared to what they played in 18. Then up to 2020, Winged Foot was 7,477 when that was bludgeoned to death by Bryson. And the longest in modern times, post-2018, was Pinehurst in 24, again, won by Bryson. That played at 7,548. Mm. Bearing in mind that that was truly baked out, 7,548-yard par 70. So Shinnecock, bang in the middle. But I think what is clear here is that the fact that the fairways are particularly wide. So it looks, when you go through the research, that the fairways here are now, in most circumstances, over 40 yards wide. And if you go back to the 01 renewal that Goosen won, the old-style golf course, they were tight at 26 to 28 yards. Now, some of these holes, the 8th, for example, is 64 yards wide off the tee. 64. Mm. I mean, that's kind of Kapalua,
yeah,
type widths that we saw or used to. I think they're going back there next year, but what you see at the Centra.
Yeah.
And we do know from history, and I know JJ Spawn is an outlier, but Spawn's an outlier in so many ways. But we'll go into that later on in the pod. This golf course in 18 undoubtedly featured a leaderboard. Koepka was second for driving distance. DJ, who finished third, was fifth. Tony Finau finished fifth. You can see why Tony Finau went well here. Not that he's qualified this year, on the basis that it didn't feature any water off the tee. He was ninth for driving distance. And then if we go down into the other each-way payers, Hatton was 14th for driving distance. Xander was 10th for driving distance. So of the top nine, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the top 15 for driving distance on that week.
Yeah.
So I genuinely believe that this is going to be a US Open where, as ever, the talk will be around the 4 3/4 inch semi-rough that's surrounding fairways and then the waist-high fescue that's the other side of that semi-rough corridor. There'll be pictures of balls disappearing. It's a shame Kevin Na's not playing. He was always the first, wasn't he, to put up on social media how deep the rough was. No wonder his US Open record wasn't the greatest with Kevin Na. But I genuinely think that this golf course will eventually succumb to a winner that is a long driver of the golf ball.
Yeah.
And it's how well that they can play firm, windy conditions that will work it through.
Yeah, and it may be those conditions that ultimately dictate the who actually prevails out of that. I think the way the holes are oriented and they're almost canted to the kind of the shape of the hole to the rooting of the course, and
yeah. There
are a number of holes where if you get the drive and you kind of hit the right part of the fairway as it's as it lands, then you're going to get propelled forward, and you know, particularly if it's firm and fast, which kind of looks like it's likely to be the case. So you'd imagine that the driving distances will be relatively high anyway. The penalty for being too far offline and into the rough is likely going to be, you know, whatever the percentage of a shot will be for each missed fairway, but it will be substantial, as you often expect from a US Open. And the bunkering, I mean, we're not really touched on the bunkering, but it's pretty extensive, particularly around the greens, and that the sand traps are proper sand traps. You know, there's going to be a penalty of some description on average for missing those targets. So plenty of challenges out there for the players that will keep them on their toes.
Feedback from players that have already played there, and lots of them have been up there. Mm. You know, they've all taken their private jet trips up. The fairways are wider now than they were in 18. They've taken some of the rough away.
Yeah.
So from a driving perspective, it's taking you even further away from accurate drivers. But I do think, and the intrigue in this course is not just distance, it's accurate driving in terms of being on the right side of fairways to then access pin position. Mm. So there's a hell of a lot of strategy in this golf course. Hell of a lot. But you like, Barry, you like it as a test, yeah? You're looking forward to this.
Can't wait. Yeah. It's very appetizing. I'm going to be watching a lot of it next week, as pretty much all the way through Thursday to Sunday.
Quite a lot of undulation in the course, and quite a few blind tee shots as well.
Yep. Yeah, some elevated tees, aren't there? There's tees that are sitting, greens that are sitting above the players. The 11th, yes. That's the 11th, the par 3, isn't it? Which sits.
That's evil.
Yeah.
That's just, I don't know, landed on what, the roof of a car kind of vibe. There's a few tee shots there that are, the tee box is dead flat to the ground, and you really are kind of blinded to where the fairway is. So there's going to be a lot of trust in lines picked and committing to that line and hitting it. As wide as these fairways are, they're running out. You know, I'm not sure drive, you know, that can impact your driving accuracy. So, you know, a lot of commitment to, yeah, these kind of shots with doubt in them, I guess. And yeah, you could easily. Wait, what are you guys feeling in terms of potential for who will be the, you know, driving accuracy percentage wise? You think somebody could be up there at 75-80% this week or next week?
Well,
sorry.
Well, Koepka was 55th for driving accuracy in 2018, and he was 64% of fairways hit. Mm. Tommy Fleetwood hit the most amount of fairways, 85.7%.
That's a lot of fairways. And that's before they were widened as well.
Yes. Justin Rose was second for driving accuracy. He hit 83.9%.
Mm. It's one of those rare courses where the driving accuracy percentage is higher than the greens in regulation. It tends to be the other way around. So that, in that respect, it gives you an indication as to where the challenge really is. And hitting and holding the greens is going to be one of the major challenges. It also brings, what was Koepka's greens in reg? I've got it.
68.1. He was fourth in that particular category.
Yeah. So that, I think that puts it into context, because if you're missing, even if the winner, who's right up there as one of the very best on the week, is missing nearly a third of his greens, then you're going to need to be getting up and down an awful lot in order to maintain your position. I did note down, and I found this quite interesting, that every single player in the field who made the cut made double figures bogeys over the course of the week. So every single player was in the double digits in terms of bogeys. Brooks made 11 and two doubles as well. Patrick Reed, who's got a fantastic short game, he finished fourth. Patrick Reed made 20 bogeys on the week.
Wow.
And finished fourth. So you imagine a card where you are making five bogeys every single day on average, and you're still in contention. He was in contention to win that title from memory, maybe, and to the first part of the back nine, and then it kind of dropped away a little bit.
Yeah, so, just looking at his card here, he bogeyed 9, 11, and 12, but he started out with five birdies in the first seven holes. So their scoring is available, but it's when it goes wrong. Can you limit it to a bogey versus a double bogey? And can you avoid a train of bogeys arriving onto your card?
Mm. Yeah, and does that lend itself to players? And you can kind of see why Brooks won then. Because in terms of mentality, in terms of being able to differentiate himself from the field by brushing off bogeys and just moving on, making the birdie on the next hole, bounce back or a couple of holes later and just carrying on and continuing to not necessarily accumulate a score, but not hemorrhage shot after shot.
Mm.
Perhaps that's the kind of mindset and mentality that needs to be built into the thought process.
Steely determination.
Mm.
We get that factor in play next week.
Yeah, stoicism. It's that kind of that grit and guile and the kind of stuff that we've been hoping our golfers can actually demonstrate in recent weeks.
I just to get it out there, there were no strokes gained data that were publicly available and up. Not even now publicly available. You can data golf, there's nothing where you can get strokes gained data from 2018, even though it was only 8 years ago. But that was Mike Davis and the USGA. They were kind of prehistoric, weren't they, in a lot of the way that they thought back in that day. Mm. But I'm just taking some basic stats here. So let's look at driving distance in 2018. Let's look at the top fives in each category. So driving distance. Ryan Fox was first. He finished 41st. Brooks Koepka was second. He finished first. Gary Woodland was third. He finished 36th. Johnny Vegas was fourth, 41st. Dustin Johnson was fifth. He finished third. Total driving, so the mix of driving distance and accuracy. Tommy Fleetwood was first for that week. He finished second. Dustin Johnson was second for total driving. He finished third. Louis Oosthuizen was third. He finished 16th. Gary Woodland was fourth, 36th. Fifth was Mathieu Pavon, finished 25th. Then we go greens in regulation. Hao Tong Lee, believe it or not, was first for greens in reg here in 18. Finished 16th. Tommy Fleetwood was tied second for greens in reg, finished second. He was tied with Dustin Johnson, who finished third. Brooks Koepka was fourth. He won. Fifth, Matt Fitzpatrick, he finished 12th. So, alluding to what Paul was saying, the perfect mix really was driving distance allied to total driving, and greens in regulation was the key. Fleetwood was second, finished second. He was tied second with Dustin Johnson, who finished third. And Brooks Koepka was fourth for greens in reg and finished first.
Hmm.
So would you put driving distance as the least important? Let's say there's four things: approach, short game, putting, driving distance. Would you put driving distance as the fourth most important thing next week, with approach being number one, and then fill in probably like short game and putting two and three? I think that's how I'd have it. I don't think there's a perfect answer to it, but nuances, but...
Personally, when I look at this, on a US Open setup, I'll always take raw driving distance over accuracy. Now, on this setup, that's going to be even more of a situation where accuracy doesn't really matter. But if you are long and... how many times has this been said? If you're long and straight...
and can hit a bunch of greens, and can scramble when you don't.
But it's basically ball striking heaven, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
And if you can do that in gusting 30-mile-an-hour winds on a really firm golf course, And you might be able to scramble a little bit as well. There you go. You're going to be US Open champion 2026.
Simple.
You'll want to be putting so well from that kind of 12 foot and in range. Just, you know, those, you're going to have those long, lengthy par putts, and I think that's going to be a huge factor. Like that grit, determination, not wanting to drop a shot or not wanting to drop, you know, make that 8 footer for bogey versus you know it turning into a double bogey.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. It's minimizing those mistakes, and some of those par putts will feel like birdies because of the nature of the way the hole's played. And like, if it is blowy, then some of the holes are going to be absolutely brutal, and in some cases, par will be an extremely good score on some holes.
Yeah, you'd be gaining what, like half to three quarters of a shot on the field or something like that if it's a, you know, particularly brutal day for wind direction on that hole.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Yeah, par will be gaining.
Mm, definitely.
Now I can hear people shouting at the podcast saying, "Yeah, but 2018, boys, it was severely baked out." And 2018, you know, Mike Davis was the kind of guy that the course was virtually unplayable on the Saturday. Are they, you know, is Mother Nature, is the USGA in 2026 going to make it that kind of test all over again? So I've had a look here at what rain has hit Shinnecock since the start of March this year. So let's run through these rain stats. March itself, 3.54 inches, that equates to 90 millimetres. April, 1.29 inches, which equates to 33 millimetres. May, 1.53 inches, 38 millimetres. Now, I do this every week for golf courses across the PGA Tour. These numbers are very, very small amounts of precipitation. And then we get to June. 0.07 inches of rain, which is 1.8 millimetres.
Yeah, virtually nothing.
Now, I live in leafy Hertfordshire outside of London, and Paul isn't a million miles away from my location. Clearly, Barry lives in Ireland, so it rains there every day anyway. We know that. But over here in Hertfordshire, we have had 55 millimetres of rain so far in June. And I can't remember a day in June where it hasn't rained. Mm. I'm just trying to put it into context here. They had very little rain at Shinnecock for now going on for 2 weeks. So the only moisture that that course is seeing is what the course superintendent and the USGA want to see here in that golf course. And I did, and I quoted this, I did mention it in podcast 400, which was for the Canadian Open, so the previous podcast to this. Alex Fitzpatrick said on an interview that when they went there last week, they were on the 11th, the famous 11th green, and the wind was blowing, and they could not find a part of the green where they could just drop a ball out of their hand and it wouldn't roll off the putting surface. So I don't think the USGA are going to get it, let it bake out so that these greens are brown and dead. They know that there's going to be wind in the forecast. But undoubtedly, this golf course is going to play as a firm and fast test. It has to. And Barry's looked at his weather app. We've looked at ours. They're in the forecast on tournament week. Looks like Sunday night into Monday looks like the only opportunity where that course will get some precipitation from Mother Nature heading into tournament week.
Mm.
Yep. And then there's a risk of rain Thursday into Friday.
Yeah, but not much, and probably not enough to make a difference given that it's been relatively dry, as you say, or very dry for the last fortnight or so.
I know it's early doors, Paul, as well, but what wind forecast are you seeing for the US Open?
Yeah, well, we're only getting it up until kind of Saturday at the moment, but Thursday, was looking, well, if it's right, like this is a week out, so things change, but I was seeing wind gusts of kind of 35, 40 miles an hour. And okay, if that materializes across that course, then wow, scoring is going to be, I think it's going to be challenging those numbers that you described earlier for the, for the stroke average back in 2018.
If that materializes, this might turn into a no bet event for me because it'll be too stressful watching your guys out there.
Oh, you'd just be salivating watching it, Barry.
It'll be an amazing watch regardless. Yeah, I've seen it a bit. There's, the models are a bit different, and it is a week out, and you know it's summer, so there's plenty of movement in the air. But certainly looks like there won't be much in terms of calmness. There'll be something to deal with for these players every day. And that's a very, very appealing thing. Like Lynx similar golf courses need wind for them to play to their potential. It's kind of, yeah, we've seen what happens like opens when it's calm, and or any Lynx tournament when it's calm, and it's, yeah, it's kind of not boring, but it, you're missing something there that could make it far more interesting.
Yeah, it looks like the wind's coming off the south or southwest or potentially southeast as well, which, given the way that the ground or the island works there on Long Island, then that's going to mean that the wind's blowing directly off the sea pretty much. So, yeah, it's going to make some particularly challenging holes. I think we probably just need to go and map how that looks, but as to whether that has a bearing on how you as a punter decide to play it next week, I think you're just gonna have to have players that you feel can handle the mental and the kind of the wind challenge that's out there should that materialize.
Greens in regulation numbers on the green on the PGA Tour: Scheffler 1, Koepka 2, Kiefer 3, Johnny McIlroy 4, Matt Fitzpatrick 6, Hao Tong Lee, there's a name that you wouldn't expect to mention twice on a US Open research podcast. He's in 7th. Ryo Hitsatsuni at 9, Colin Morikawa 11, Justin Rose 12.
Yeah. Just to add a little bit to that, because I've started to dig through what the wider greens and reg would look like when we incorporate the DP World Tour players and also the LIV players. So I think adding to that list you've got there, you'll have the likes of John Rahm, who's been hitting an awful lot of greens on the LIV Tour. Nathan Kimsey ranked highly as well from a DP World Tour perspective. Alex Fitzpatrick is right up there. I mean, as we know, he's massively stepped up in terms of his performances of late. He doesn't appear yet on the PGA Tour stats, so he kind of gets lost in that respect. But he has been hitting an awful lot of greens, which I think has got to be taken note of. Patrick Reed, we seem to mention Patrick Reed every time we have this conversation on these pre-pods, but once again, he's been hitting a lot of greens. Brooks Koepka as well, featured highly on some of the numbers that I did. I mean, we've talked about Brooks a few times in the pods recently, and if he can find some semblance of form with the putter, then he's that kind of character that I wouldn't put it past him to go and effectively retain his Shinnecock title, having won it back in 2018. That kind of player. It's just the putter, isn't it? We know with Brooks. That's...
If you see any signs of life with the putter at this week's RBC Canadian Open in TPC Toronto, Koepka's going to be an interesting punt, I think.
Yes. Indeed. Yeah, mentality-wise, he's got it. He's, you know, we know from the way he's described the majors in the past, he feels he's only battling with a very small percentage of the field because the rest of them have already beaten before they started.
Let's take some background of recent US Open, shall we? So I will put a link in the podcast description to the research article that I've written for this. Recent US Open history features a new breed of champion with first-time major winners galore. Going back to 2009, 13 of the last 17 champions, that's 77% by my rudimentary mathematics, had never captured a major title when winning. 13 of the last 17.
Yeah, that's pretty significant.
So that would include the likes of Rory's first major was the US Open, wasn't it? At Congressional.
Yep.
Dustin Johnson's was a first major at Oakmont. The list is wide.
Yeah, Matt Fitz. Yeah,
and long.
There's plenty, isn't there?
John Rahm was his first at Torrey Pines. I'm trying to think. Bryson DeChambeau, clearly it was his second when he won at Pinehurst a couple of years ago, yeah?
Mm.
So it does lend itself to golfers that make a breakthrough as their first major win. Which I think does come across. I mean, JJ Spawn last year, Wyndham Clark in 23, Fitzpatrick in 22, Rahm in 21. Brooks Koepka is the one of the exceptions. Isn't he? He won 17, was his first major, and then he won in 18 to defend here at Shinnecock.
Yeah.
And Jordan Spieth did double this. Did the 2015 double of winning the Masters and then the US Open, because back then the PGA was still played in August.
Yeah.
Justin Rose's only major championship, 2013. So, you know, this trend, Webb Simpson, Graham McDowell, it just goes back and back and back. So 77% of the last 17 champions, 13 have been first-time majors. Now, let's look at the major championships that have been played in northeastern United States since the start of 2013. There's been 10 of them. New York State, where this is being played, has hosted 4. Pennsylvania, 3. New Jersey, 2. Massachusetts, 1. Which would have been Fitzpatrick at Brookline. This goes back to the 2013 US Open won by Justin Rose at Marion in Pennsylvania. Nationality-wise, Justin and Matt Fitzpatrick have been the only non-Americans to triumph, both from England. Duffner, DJ, Jimmy Walker, Brooks Koepka times two, Bryson DeChambeau times two, and JJ Spawn, all being victorious for the home nation. So last 10 majors in the northeast of the United States, 2 Europeans, 2 from England, 8 American winners. I'm just getting this out there for context, really.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting background.
Have you got any thoughts, Barry, around the kind of players that you'll be looking for next week?
I mean, shock, horror, Rory's popping in my head. This iteration of Rory is grittier, can play and battle on courses with different kind of scoring dynamics. Mentally, he probably feels like he dropped one at Pinehurst when Bryson won there, and he wants he wants marquee victories with that at the, you know, the marquee venues, and it doesn't get much better than Shinnecock in terms of a very notable US Open victory. So I really got him in the head. Scotty at the moment, look, he's going to be there regardless because he's Scotty, but it's a little bit stinky at the moment, the game. Just not quite. I mean, I know he still manages B or C games, still gets him into really good situations, but I just don't know whether the win is quite there. We off mic, you know, I don't know, one of yourselves mentioned Chris Goderup. I think he's definitely in mind for this for me now as well, just based on what we were talking about, the Scottish Open performance, recent majors as well, just popping up with good performances. Like, I think, you know, he's got that kind of low bullety ball flight, which I think will really help. I even think at this stage, as much as abusive as I've given him over the years, would it shock me if Russell Henley won this? Very solid player, good, you know, as far as I'm concerned, good in the wind. Just had a recent win, so his confidence is going to be sky high. Unbelievable in terms of consistency of high performances in majors. I might have to bet him. I know.
My mum always used to say, wash your mouth out with soap.
With soap and water, yeah, exactly.
My Lord.
This is a fascinating thing, but he has perturbed me over the years, I do like winning money, so I think he's got a very valid chance.
Well, to back you up on this, Paul pulls together some really interesting stats about major performance, and I'm looking at the two-year major performance cycle, yeah? Which is actually the way we're looking at it here, the way we're breaking it down. Of course, it includes the Masters from 26 and the PGA from 26. So we're actually looking at 10 majors back to the start of 24. Scottie Scheffler has been the best player in majors. 69.45 scoring average across 10 events. Xander second, only 0.2 behind Scheffler. 69.65. That's pretty impressive stuff from Xander. Yeah. Next up is Rory, 70.24. So that's over a half stroke higher than Xander. But he has won two Masters. Clearly, Xander in that time has won a PGA and a Open. I'm going to just go through the bigger names. But interestingly enough, as part of this analysis, there's Andrew Putnam in there. Alex Smalley, interesting, finished second at PGA at Merion.
Yeah, it did.
Not Merion, at Aronimink.
Yeah.
And then you come to a name, Chris Goderup. Now, Chris has played five majors across that time period. The first one, he missed the cut at the PGA in 24. But from that point onwards, you know, modern day Chris Goderup, he's finished 23rd at the US Open last year, 3rd at the Open, 24th at the Masters on debut, and 10th at the PGA. So at 70.44, he's only 0.2 of a stroke behind Rory McIlroy.
The Open and the Open performance last year and the third Scottish place, yeah. Open, the Scottish Open win are the things that are really popping out for me there.
Yeah.
Yep. Then underneath Goderup, we have DeChambeau at 70.50. Justin Rose at 70.56. Rose has been amazing, really. Sixth, I'm just reading through him, a sixth. Second at the Open in 24. Clearly, the runner-up finish at the Masters behind Rory in 25. And then the last two, he's had a third at the Masters, which, you know, he says himself he threw away. And 10th last time out at Aronimink.
Yeah.
Then you're down to the likes of Alex Noren, who's got a very non-top 10 group of results, but consistent top 12s, 13s. And then you go out to the likes of, interestingly enough, Russell Henley at 70.85. And within that, he's got five top 10 major finishes in his last 10 majors. He now sits actually above Colin Morikawa and the nemesis that is Ludvig Åberg. I don't see Ludvig Åberg as a US Open winner at Shinnecock, I have to say.
If you took away Russell Henley's name from his stats there in majors and just say, this guy won recently, has blah, blah, blah attributes, has won a few times on tour, and here's his results in majors, and he's probably in around 40 to 50 to 1, you know, something around that, you'd be looking to get that bet on.
I'm just going through players here that are sub 70 or 71 and sub. There's only a couple extra there that we can throw at it. I'm talking about players that play a lot of majors. Maverick McNealy, Patrick Reed, and interestingly enough, I think another name that's going to grow some heat, especially in a world where US Open winners tend to be first-time major winners, Christopher Reitan. He's finished 30th, 41st and 44th in his first three majors, going back to the Open last year.
Yeah, I'm not sure he goes back-to-back after winning this week as well, Steve, but we'll see.
Can he win three out of his last, out of four tournaments? Or was it three out of five? One, something like that.
Yeah, he's counting.
Yeah, wins Quail, wins the Canadian Open, because you're on him this week, and then, of course, takes out the US Open.
That would be some rise to superstardom, wouldn't it? Interesting with Scotty as well, because it will be, if should he win, it will be his career Grand Slam. And the Sunday of US Open week, US Open Sunday, is his 30th birthday, which is one of those life events that, you know, alongside a nappy factor, is something that certainly I keep an eye on for those kind of things, 30th, 40th birthdays and the like. So interesting to see if that adds a level of pressure or a level of, I don't know, just gives him an extra impetus to move forward. We've talked about before about Scotty on courses where there are significant variables in play, and whether that impacts his ability to go and win a golf tournament. And I wonder if it is a tough, windy renewal, whether that impacts Scotty's ability to win the golf tournament.
You're talking about interview comments along the lines of, I don't think it's a fair test.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's going to be unfair in that respect, but I think they're going to be, I think,
variables. I know what you're saying. This isn't a Bryson DeChambeau major to win, because he just will not be able to compute all of these different variables.
Yeah, I don't know. There's so much you need to kind of throw at these, throw at the analysis you do to try and work out where or how to pitch your team next week. But yeah, to your point from the podcast earlier in the week, Scotty's out to, 6-1 in places for this coming, or for the US Open. And, you know, having just eyeballed him over the last few weeks, he seems quite a frustrated character. So wonder how that manifests next week as well.
Came out yesterday that Colin Morikawa has had a child.
Okay.
Hence why you haven't seen him for a few weeks. Baby swag.
Yeah, and Tyrrell Hatton as well. He won on Live last weekend, didn't he? And he's recently become a father as well. There's those factors to try and build into the equation this week as well. I have done a little bit of analysis to try and, as I often do with these things, to try and chop the field down a bit. So I'll take you quickly through that, just to give Steve a break for a couple of minutes as well. Just with some trends that have been fairly consistent over the last few years on the US Open. As you alluded to earlier, JJ Spawn kind of throws a lot of thought processes out from his win last year, but I think we can still work with it. I went back 20 years actually before calling it a day in that respect. And every US Open winner I could find had recorded a top three finish at some point that season. Now, I guess you could kind of say, well, yeah, I'd expect my player to be playing reasonably well or to have semi-contended or contended or even won at some point in the recent past. But I've got a field of 149 at the moment, so there's another seven to be confirmed between now and next Thursday. I expect we'll get a fuller view on Saturday morning or Friday night. But yeah, of that 149, if you take out every player who hasn't had a top three finish so far this season, you are down to 56 players out of 149. So it does chop the field down quite a bit. You're losing players, and there's some big names here, actually. You're losing players of the likes of Tommy Fleetwood. His best, it was at the Memorial, so it's recent, and fourth at the Memorial. Justin Thomas, Steve, your old mate. Harris English, who was red-hot property last year in terms of selections. Sam Burns, Adam Scott, Sung Jae-im. I know you always like a bit of Sung Jae-im, Barry, at the... championships.
It was a 1 week. I dated him for 1 week, and it's gone. I was looking. I did a little peek at his U.S. Open record. It's no bueno. So yeah. I don't think
you've dropped him. Well, two reasons to drop him as well, because he hasn't had that top three. Dustin Johnson is improving on Live DJ and had that decent outing here back in 2018. Cam Smith, seventh at the PGA Championship, but that's his best effort of the season. Patrick Cantlay, I'll say no more. Brooks Koepka, who we mentioned a second ago, his best this year is ninth. And there's evidently some improvement there in his game. And some of the metrics, some of the long game metrics coming out of Brooks's game have been fantastic. It's just that putter that's holding him back. But if you're as brutal as chopping everyone out for not having had a top three finish this season, then Brooks is gone. Victor Hovland, another one. So I say you get down from 149 to 56 by doing this. Now, since we've moved to the current major schedule, all seven of the winners, and this includes JJ Spawn, had a top 10 finish in one of their last four starts. So, and that even includes the COVID year. So you could get even more brutal and say, well, you need to have had top 10 in the last four, as well as a top three in the season. And if you do that, you're down to 40 players. You lose Hideki, you lose the likes of Jason Day and Minwoo Lee, Shane Lowry, Bob McIntyre, Akshay Bhatia. There's plenty of big names disappearing. And then a couple more just to chop the field down a little bit more, and then we'll have a short list, or shorter list at least. Six of the last seven major or US Open winners had a top 40 or better in one of the two majors so far that year. So kind of using the stats that Steve was looking at, but getting even more precise and just looking at the 2026 data. If you haven't had a top 40 so far in one of the two majors, then you're out. So that loses the likes of Sepp Straka, Christopher Reitan, as Steve just mentioned, Nikolai Højgaard, yeah. Ricky Fowler, Alex Fitzpatrick as well. And Bryson DeChambeau, miscut from his two majors so far this season. So you're down to 24 at that point. And if you take it a step further, the final step, five of those same seven players had a top 10 or better in one of the two majors that year to date. So the person who drops out there is JJ Spawn, who didn't have that top 10. But five of the most recent seven US Open winners had a top 10 in one of the, either the Masters or the PGA Championship, aside from the COVID year, of course, which was all messed up. Now, we're down to a final list of 15 if we chop it down to that level, having lost the likes of Matt Fitz and Ben Griffin, Joaquin Neiman. Wyndham Clark drops out at that point as well, who I have backed anti-post. Siwoo Kim has been playing well all year. Anyway, the final 15, this is in world ranking order as it stands. So if my rudimentary mathematics from this criteria is correct, then the winner will come from one of these 15 players. And they are Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, Cam Young, Russell Henley, Barry, you'd be glad to hear, Justin Rose, John Rahm, Colin Morikawa, Chris Gotterup, another one you just mentioned, Xander, Aaron Rye, Ludwig, Tyrrell Hatton, Patrick Reed, Kurt Kitayama falls into that category. And to top it all, Steve, your post-it note of doom re-entry candidate, Alex Smalley, falls into the final 15 as well. Perhaps it's his year.
Alex Smalley is the kind of player that would pop into... I don't think I can actually exclude him from my short list of candidates for the US Open. And as we saw last year with JJ Spawn, he won off a miscut.
The immediate finish of the most recent US Open winners hasn't been that great. It's not sparkling. It's not firsts or seconds. You know, there's some tenths and twelfths in there, but there's some miscuts. And yeah, it's almost as if you need to come in relatively rested, but with some form in the recent past, and then just go and win the US Open. Just take the title out.
I have scanned all the way back to Dustin Johnson in 2016 for a player that has won the US Open off a previous single-digit finish.
Mm. There you go.
That's crazy.
And that probably helps the price as well, because players, there's always going to be this recency bias, and I'm sure players who do well at the Canadian Open this week are going to be scythed in terms of their price if they're playing next week in Shinnecock. So yeah, it's not necessarily the case to go with the absolute hottest of form, but something that looks good from the last month or so, and certainly for the season to date, could be the pointer.
Steve, you can back Mr. Smalley now on the exchange at 180 for his first win.
There you go.
You can back him at Luke Littler on the exchange. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I just while we were doing this, I've backed Gotterup and Henley on the exchange just to stop myself talking myself out of it. Which I've often done, and to my detriment. And scrolling down the odds, I just noted Gary Woodland, former US Open champion, low ball flight. It's a long way. He's 170 on the exchange. So I added a little bit of Gary just for fun. I know I'm breaking my rule about not backing him, but that was an irresistible price for a winner this season.
Mm.
I've got a list of players that can't win the 2026 US Open. Do you want me to take you through them?
Can't win. Yeah, go on then.
Akshay Bhatia. This is going to be long and studious because with my pronunciations, of course. Patrick Cantlay. Eric Cole. Could just about manage him. Jason Day. This one's going to be contentious. Tommy Fleetwood. Ricky Fowler. Ryan Gerrard, given current form. Ben Griffin. Brian Harman, Russell Henley, Victor Hovland, Sung Jae Im, Siwoo Kim, Shane Lowry, Hideki Matsuyama, Colin Morikawa, Alex Noren, JT Poston, who just won the Memorial Tournament, Aaron Rye, who just won the PGA Championship, Sepp Straka, and JJ Spawn, who is the defending US Open champion. Have you any idea why that list of players won't win the 2026 US Open?
They're all in the waiting room for the post-it note.
On the sub post-it note, yeah. Is it something to do? Is it something to do with length that didn't sound?
Driving distance, yes. If I exclude Matt Fitzpatrick, who, as I said earlier in the podcast, won a lot around the shortest US Open test that we've seen in recent times, which wasn't a long golf course. So if we take long and medium long kind of golf courses and we say, right, let's look at it from a driving distance perspective. And I'm including Bryson DeChambeau within this, although he's a LIV player. But if his driving distance rank would have been first on the PGA Tour for LIV, that particular point of time when he won the US Open. The shortest driver of the golf ball going back to 2015 was 78th in the driving distance listings on the PGA Tour, arriving at the course where they won the US Open. Mm. So if I take the top 80 of the current PGA Tour driving distance listings and say that's a cutoff, I'm losing all of those names.
Okay.
That is prior to the end of this week of the RBC Canadian Open. So there'll be a small change or churn in that group.
Mm. Is my brain a mess? Did you mention Fitzy in that list?
No.
No, okay. He's 58th in driving distance. He's
added length.
306.6.
Alex Small is not in that list either, by the way. Now, I can take it to another extreme, and this is when we start going down this route of, you know, JJ Spall would actually have been within that list last, not within it, would have been, he'd have passed that test last year, by the way.
Yeah.
Because Spawn was 58th for driving distance when he won the US Open last year. Now, I can go even more extreme, of course, and now we get into one of these scenarios, you know, that people can't defend the green jacket and blah, 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 all these trends. But you've gone through a trend as well, Paul, so let's just throw it out there. 8 of the last 11 would have been in the top 20 for driving distance on the PGA Tour. The exceptions are, of course, Fitzpatrick, I've already mentioned, Jordan Spieth in 2015, and JJ Spawn last year, who was 58th. But apart from those, all of the other winners would have been in the top 20 for driving distance. So let's just go through those names as it stands right now. Ludvig Åberg, I'm not interested. Michael Brennan, Sam Burns, Pearson Coody, Chris Gotterup, Nikolaj Højgaard, Johnny Kiefer, Kurt Kitayama, there's a name, Paul, Jake Knapp, will he play, Minwoo Lee, Rory McIlroy, Aldridge Podgieter, Xander, you can never get rid of Xander out of a trend, can you? Michael Teor Bjornsson. And if I'm being uber generous, let's include those up to 25. Ryan Fox, who was top of driving distance here last time they played in 2018. Brooks Koepka, who won. And Barry's favourite, Keith Cashmere Mitchell. And of course, I can throw in from the LIV stats so far this year, Bryson DeChambeau and John Rahm.
Yeah.
Food for thought.
Some likely candidates in there, I think.
If you could find a player that's really good at hitting greens in regulation at the moment and is in the top 20 for driving distance, I mean, clearly John Rahm is just John Rahm. He hits greens for fun, whatever tour he's on. He's long enough. But it would really shorten the list, undoubtedly. What do you think?
Certainly a lot to chew on. Yeah, I get the length point. Going back historically, I know we've got strokes gained now, which kind of has moved the world on. But one of the stats that historically used to be a fair indicator was total driving, and I haven't got the number to hand, but maybe 4 of the last 12 or 14 or whatever US Open champions had finished first for total driving on their immediately previous start. So players who are hitting it long and straight have tended to be more likely to prevail in this event. So yeah, I get the logic, and I guess the wind is the factor that just brings a few other elements into play.
Is there anything you chaps would like to add, or do you think that's the end of our US Open in-depth research podcast for 2026?
Brain scrambled, I think. There's so much to try and work through that, yeah. Called it a day, I think.
I think the thing we found is that it's very, it's hard to really narrow it down to one or two absolute fancies.
Mm.
And I think it's because US Open has that little bit of chaos and variability in it. And that is probably lurking in the back of our minds and what stats we're trying to pick out on. You know, your player could just be torched immediately. So, it's going to be hard to have supreme conviction on any one player next week and just be absolutely confident they will top five or be in the running for a win. Because I think they're all susceptible to being annihilated by a very good golf course and some what look to be testing conditions.
Mm.
Agreed. Undoubtedly. Right, our US Open Tips podcast will be out on Tuesday the 16th of June. Until then, I wish you the very best. I hope your RBC Canadian selections go well in the intervening period, and we'll be back next week. I'll see you soon.
If you like betting on golf, but everyone that you back misses the cut, get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more, 'cause it's the golf betting system, the golf